You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Wouldn't it be great if most of the electricity generated in America came from wind and solar instead of climate-wrecking fossil fuels? Of course it can't be done, except it can. Who says so? Hippies from California? Not quite. It's all in a new paper by a former senior scientist at NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and a physicist math whiz from CSERES, the Cooperative Institute for Research in Environmental Sciences at the University of Colorado in Boulder. Let's see if we can map the energy future with Dr. Alexander McDonald, known as Sandy, the recently retired director of NOAA's Earth System Research Lab, and Dr. Christopher Clack from CSERES. And they're all in Boulder, Colorado. Sandy and Chris, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Okay, thank you, Alex.
Hello, thank you.
Let's start with you, Sandy. What the heck? How did NOAA come to post a study on how to power America with alternative energy?
It really started 6 years ago when I was really looking at why people say wind and solar won't work. You know, they said, well, they're too intermittent and they're too expensive. And I thought, gee, that isn't true. That's intermittent if you have a little area like the size of one state or something like that. But what is really evident to somebody who studied weather for a few decades is the scale of weather is big. So if you want to have a big enough area so that if it's not blowing in one place, it'll be blowing another, you can't go with something small like the state of Kansas. It must be much bigger. So we set out to study that and in the process really looked at all the aspects of how wind and solar energy could go into the electric system.
Chris Clack, how did you get involved in figuring out this potential for solar and wind power?
So I came into the project to look at how I could build a model to try and incorporate these different technologies using really high detailed weather data. And it was quite a difficult computational task to get the model to be able to bring in all these millions of bytes of data to do the number crunching to also include all the salient features of the electric grid as well. And so I came in as a mathematician to try and build that model to try and make it as accurate as we could.
And as you said, Sandy, the big question with wind and sun has always been their intermittent nature. The sun goes down behind the clouds and the wind can stop blowing. Sandy, can we get past that really?
We really can. And Chris's model was pretty marvelous. It basically showed that if you tell the model you have to minimize annual costs, but you can put wind and solar anywhere you want. In our case, we were studying the United States, so we were looking at the 48 contiguous states. And you can use other things like transmission or storage or whatever. But the model itself was built around take these components of the electric system and find the least expensive configuration of a national system. And so Chris developed the model, and we did probably a couple hundred runs of different kinds. And so we're talking in our paper about one that was really important, which was using wind and solar and natural gas whenever, in fairly rare cases, when you don't have enough wind and solar. And we looked at the size that you need. So we divided the U.S. into really small areas the way the AC power system drives us to, that is the alternating current, which really has to be used in fairly small areas. And what the paper talks about is the simulator basically says you can get low-cost and low-carbon energy by using the largest possible domain. So we thought it was a very important result from this new simulator that Chris had developed.
And the other monumental challenge is the need for storage, or do we need storage at all?
The interesting thing is storage is one of the things we included in this optimization. So it's always going to look at things like offshore wind and storage and long-line transmission, long-line being like these big high-voltage DC transmission. And it's going to decide which is the least cost. In the case of storage at the estimated cost for 2030, which was the year that we took as our target, it did not use the storage, and it also used very little offshore wind. So this is basically an economic study that says build the lowest cost system in the simulator to tell us what the policy options are for the future. Chris, you might want to add to that.
I agree. Essentially, what happened was when we put everything into the model with the cost estimates that we had, storage just didn't play a major role. The transmission itself allowed us to use space and time as the storage medium. So as storms move through, the power can be distributed across the U.S. the majority of the time, and then the natural gas can then be used as peaking plants or backup plants to fill in the gaps, which ended up being cheaper than having storage put in.
But, you know, I've seen studies that say about half of the electricity produced in the United States today is lost in transmission. Chris, if the wind is blowing in the west and we need that electricity in New York City, how does it get there?
So in the model, one of the major components with the national system that the simulator sort of developed is that there's this HVDC overlay on top of the existing transmission. So it's high voltage direct current instead of the alternating current. And what that allows us to do is it actually has lower losses than the traditional AC, and it allows power to be shipped much further. And so with that, we can move power from, say, the desert southwest to New York with roughly 12% losses. But that's actually far less than you would have with AC, and the power would get there at the frequency you need it for that particular market. And so what it allows us to do is be more efficient with the system rather than just shipping it along AC. If you do it with AC, there's lots of technical difficulties that you have to do to try and move it longer distances, which adds up to more and more losses.
Has this DC transmission line been done anywhere in the world? Is it a real technology?
My comment is it's a well-known technology. People have been using it for many, many years. There's a high-voltage DC line that goes from Oregon to Southern California, and the Chinese have just built two big, long, very powerful lines of HVDC. Alberta just created a 300-mile line. So a key component of our study was to say, we were only going to look at technologies that exist today, that we know what their costs are, at least can get good estimates for the next 15 years by 2030, and nothing that was sort of like, well, we need a breakthrough or something. We weren't going to allow those, because the key thing is, I think the problem of mitigating carbon dioxide really can't wait. As director of NOAA's Earth System Research Lab, until a month ago, a lot of our studies were how urgent it is to do something about CO2, and this was kind of looking at the other end of it, saying, well, can we use the weather data to tell us something that would really work with existing technology? So it was really a kind of the other half of the problem that was very exciting to work on.
So how do we know where solar power will turn on, and how can you calculate what to expect during a year?
Well, I'll mention the weather data. We have what's called a weather assimilation model. So that's something that takes all the existing measurements at a given time, like within a given hour, like all the aircraft wind measurements and, you know, surface weather stations and satellites. It uses all that data to actually tell us what the detailed weather. We had 150,000 little rectangles over the United States and southern Canada. We'd get a value of what the winds at 80 meters would be and so on. So this extraordinarily detailed weather data every hour for 3 years at 150,000 points, we used that at the same time we had the U.S. usage of electric load, people actually turning on their toasters or whatever, at 250 areas over the United States. So we matched them in time, and we told our system, minimize the total cost for the year, but you have to meet the demand for electricity over all these different locations in the United States. And that was sort of the problem we gave Chris, and he used something called linear programming to solve it.
And Chris, when you mapped out the potential for alternative energy, does wind produce more power than solar?
So when we did the cost optimization, the results show that with the optimal solution, we actually get about 38% of the electricity from wind and 17% from solar. So it's kind of a 2-to-1 ratio. There is actually a higher potential over the whole U.S. for solar, but the problem is that solar goes to bed at night, so the sun goes down and you can't produce anything. And so actually with wind and solar together, what happens is the solar actually peaks in the middle of the day. It starts dying away, but the wind actually starts picking up as the sun goes down, as it transitions to the evening, the wind will actually pick up. And so the two together actually complement each other very nicely. But overall, because you have day and night with wind, it ends up having more energy, more electricity produced from wind than from solar.
And so how many solar panels and wind turbines would we need to power at least most of the electricity needs of America?
So the wind turbines, approximately 205,000 2.5-megawatt wind turbines placed across the U.S. And then with the solar panels, we've worked out as roughly 360 gigawatts of solar. And so I think that works out to be roughly 1 million solar panels.
So that's acres of solar panels and a lot of wind turbines. Sandy, what do you think about the inevitable battles over where to put these things?
Well, one of the things that we did is we didn't put high density. We sort of said you could put one of these every square kilometer, and we also used land use to determine all the places that they couldn't go. You couldn't put them in national parks, cities, areas that were steep slopes, all kinds of things. So we really kind of have a system where the optimizer will choose areas where they could really go, like out in the country. And if you drive around these wind farms, you'll see the farmers with their cornfields or their wheat fields, and the turbine itself is out in the middle. It's kind of a cash flow for the farmer. It's not really encumbering a lot of space. In fact, I think Chris has some calculations that it doesn't encumber a huge area.
The combination of the wind and the solar that would be developed with the combined area smaller than Rhode Island would be changed from its existing use.
And did I hear you say, gentlemen, that we can't go for 100% solar and wind? We might still need some fossil fuel backup.
Yeah, yes, the way the system works is we have natural gas power plants as what we call a dispatchable. So that means that almost all the time the wind and solar somewhere in the United States are there, but not all the time. And again, this is a cost minimization. So we're actually using whatever price the natural gas is. So essentially, if there's not enough, it will use natural gas. Now, why doesn't it use very much? It doesn't use very much because if it uses it in the optimizer, it has to pay the fuel cost, the actual natural gas that gets burned, whereas it can always, in essence, other than the capital cost, get the wind and solar for free. So it's kind of a nice way to look at it, that it will only use the fossil fuels. And another point about this is you can do something with this optimizer, like say, well, there is no natural gas available, and you have to use only wind and solar. If you did that, you might find the price is much higher because it has to essentially build out in this simulation enough wind and solar so that it always produces. And that's very similar to many economic goods. You get up to 80% reduction of carbon dioxide with no increase in cost. But if you say, boy, it has to be 100%, then you're probably going to something like double your costs of electricity. And we basically had the hypothesis that wind and solar can be effective, but not if they increase electric costs a whole lot.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Alexander Sandy McDonald, recently retired from NOAA, and Chris Clack from Ceres in Boulder, Colorado. They have mapped out how America could get most of its electric needs from solar and wind power. Well, Sandy, I know that you've been studying this. Weather patterns may change as the world warms. What about developments during climate change? Did you include that in your model?
No, we didn't. And one of the neat things about the news model that was developed by Chris is if we want to put in different weather data or different cost data, it's a model. So it's really just a tool for policymakers to say, well, what if this happens? I will say this, that I did take the time a couple years ago to look at some of our global climate models for later in the century, 2030 and 2050. And what it looks like is as the century wears on over the United States, you get a little more sun and a little less wind. But they kind of canceled each other in this very simple look that we had. But we've not done that in the model.
So what happens, though, if we can't do this? Maybe the political climate is wrong or the economy goes bad. We don't get this smart grid built. Could you see a different study that explores what happens if a few million homes all power up individually with solar, or maybe local communities mount their own wind electricity companies?
I think, you know, there's many, many options, but what I would say is we don't have a lot of time. And our study is interesting in that it says up to 80% reduction of carbon dioxide by 2030 without an increase in electric costs. So that means that if we could get everybody to conserve or everybody to put panels on their roof, we may get further, but I'd be worried that we'd get nowhere near what we need to really deal with the climate change problem.
Well, I guess just as your study showed, you know, that looking at one state isn't enough, we need to look at a great big area to make this work. Maybe it's the same with the power system. We really need a national power system.
Again, another example that I like to bring up is the interstate highway system. We didn't replace the state, federal, and local roads when we put in the interstate, but we enabled a national market. And essentially what this simulator came up with, it kind of created a national electric market for the same reason, that if you can move the electrons around much more effectively, you get lower costs, and in this case, lower carbon dioxide, which are important. So it's a little bit like President Eisenhower saying in the 1950s, this would be a very valuable economic boon to the country that will last for decades and decades, and we've certainly seen that with the interstate highways.
And, you know, regarding this intermittent nature of the sun and wind power, in order to save the climate, we might have to change our lifestyles and or even our approach to industry. Maybe we could use power just when it's available from clean sources so we don't turn on our appliances, or maybe we don't go to work in the car plant if there isn't much electricity available today. What do you think about that?
I think it's really an important thing to try to conserve. That is really important. However, I also believe that people are probably going to be using more and more electricity. One of the things that's happening is that the autos, the Nissan Leaf and the Tesla and so on, are showing how effective electric autos can be in terms of less fuel cost and so on. And so even though we should do everything we can to conserve, if the amount of electricity that people use goes up and up because of these other uses, what's our answer? Are we going to build more coal plants or whatever? So I think we have some very big questions, and we should do everything we can, like conservation, but we also need big solutions to what is really a very big problem.
So, Chris, where do you think this paper could go and the model that you've made? Could it be used by government or business? Have you had some interest yet?
I think the model itself is going to be very useful as a tool to look at different options that are available. Like Sunday's been saying, we've tested this hypothesis, and we've looked at what wind and solar can do if you look at the large scale. But it can be used in different ways to look at how you could see different policy implications. So, for example, if nuclear power was decided to stop running, what would happen? What would you use to fill that gap? What's the cost optimal solution to fill that gap? And so I think it's a very useful tool, and hopefully it will be used in the future to make more quantitative decisions on how to progress forward with a low-carbon economy.
Since Chris mentioned nuclear power, I want to mention another aspect. People hadn't really thought about it, but there was almost a requirement because of the AC, the way AC power works, is people would place nuclear power plants not very far from heavily populated areas. And so that was another effect of AC power. So a policymaker could say, well, suppose that we get a new generation of nuclear plants. If you had this high voltage DC interstate for electrons, you could actually place nuclear power plants very far from the population areas and really increase your margin of safety. So the real emergency that I think we've featured in NOAA for several decades is carbon dioxide going into the air is got huge implications, and nuclear is a carbon-free power also.
It must have been strange, Sandy, going to work every day and seeing the weather maps starting to shift over the years because of climate change.
I guess I'm one who believes weather is exciting and interesting and different every day from the time I was a little kid. And I think that weather is just variable, but the effects of carbon dioxide, which I think are quite clear in the rise of temperature and the increase in acidity of the ocean, these are effects that we understand that I think you can't look at the remainder of this century without saying, okay, we've got a big problem. What is the kind of solution that would really work?
Is there anything that either of you would like to add?
I'll make a quick comment that I mentioned the idea that electric usage will probably go up over the next 15 or 20 years as we get more electric cars, more heat pumps, which can air condition and heat a house. So we're really to solve the whole energy problem, not just the electric energy part of it. The first thing you have to do is to decarbonize the electric sector. If you decarbonize the electric sector, then autos, who some people project will be dominantly electric sometime in the 2020s, and space heating and other uses also become carbon-free. So we think this is an extraordinarily important first step for policymakers to consider this result, that there is a way to do a fairly rapid and affordable decarbonization of the electric sector.
Chris?
We've really found that wind and solar can do a lot of work in terms of decarbonizing the electric grid. And we've actually found that it can be cheaper than business as usual, so cheaper than just continuing the way we are, which I think is contrary to what a lot of people may have believed. And the only way that you can do that is if you do it more in a more smart way about how you deploy and how you put these technologies out. And so I think it's quite an interesting result, and hopefully once people look at it and see the amount of work that we put into trying to make it conservative, we might actually find that we can get more done than we actually found in the results.
Our guests are Sandy Alexander McDonald, who has been the director of NOAA's Earth System Research Lab, and Chris Clack from the Cooperative Institute for Research in Environmental Sciences at the University of Colorado Boulder. We've been talking about a new article titled Future Cost Competitive Electricity Systems and Their Impact on U.S. CO2 Emissions. It's published online in the journal Nature on January 25, 2016. You can find links to a NOAA article all about it, complete with cool maps, in my Radio EcoShock blog published Wednesdays at ecoshock.info. Thank you so much, both of you, for your help and joining us today on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
Thank you very much.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.